in the middle of a series known by the title of Head, Heart and Guts. What we've been talking about, or what we started to talk about, were the three great bodhisattvas who are known as the family protectors, the family being the family of the Buddhas. And you could say that these three protectors, Manjugosha or Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara and Vajrapani, protect the Dharma, they protect Dharma practitioners. In a way, they're representing the different aspects without which, the different qualities of enlightenment, the qualities without which there is no enlightenment. And we've had a short series on Manjushri. Vedanya stood here a few weeks ago and described the figure of Manjushri, the bodhisattva with the the bodhisattva with the flaming sword, the bodhisattva of wisdom. And Manjushri very much represents the head. He represents the intellect. He represents the qualities to do with how we think, how we conceptualize the world, how we view reality. And in a few weeks again, someone will stand here, not quite sure who's doing it actually, and talk about Vajrapani. And Vajrapani very much represents the guts, what propels us into action, what we really want. And tonight, I'm going to be talking about Avalokiteshvara, who represents the head, the heart aspect of enlightenment, what we love, what we value, what's precious to us. Okay, so a little bit about Avalokiteshvara before we lose the picture again. This is a picture of the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. It's a photograph taken by Peter Benyon, who's a Sangha member who many of you will know. He took that photograph on a roadside shrine somewhere in the Himalayas when he was walking there. And the name Avalokiteshvara has a meaning. Ava actually means down, as in, you know, downwards. Lokita is from the verb lok, which amazingly, because I always think that there'll never be any connection between Sanskrit and English. Lok means look. It means to observe or to notice. And Ishvara means Lord. So the translation of the name Avalokiteshvara is the Lord who looks down. And, this is the bodhisattva who particularly looks down on beings, who particularly notices what's happening with beings. He's known as the bodhisattva of compassion. He's the bodhisattva who notices dukkha, who notices suffering, who wants to help. And he's probably, maybe just about, one of the most ancient archetypes of Buddhism. He's revered throughout the Buddhist world, from Theravadan areas like Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia, right through Tibet and China and into Japan. And he crops up in many, many Mahayana sutras, usually because those present in the sutras are seeking his help. And images of him, or occasionally her, actually, because this bodhisattva transmogrifies and changes sex in some traditions, are among the most beautiful and actually the most bizarre. He has different names in different Buddhist traditions. And one of the weirdest things about him, and it is a him usually, is that he sometimes has he usually has more than two arms. He's shown here with four arms, and that's the most usual form. But sometimes he has an awful lot more arms than that. I was looking at pictures of a six-armed and an eight-armed Avalokiteshvara, and we have a very traditional image here of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And in this form, he bizarrely has 11 heads as well. I'll tell you more about that in a little while. So, sometimes he's known as Lokeshvara, which is just a shortening of the name. In Tibet, he's known as Chenrezig or Chenrezi. In China, he or she often is known as Kuan Yin. And we have a picture of Kuan Yin, not an image rather, of Kuan Yin, in our little alcove towards the back of the shrine room, looks very different from the Tibetan image of Kuan Yin, different mudras and iconography, but it is another form of Avalokiteshvara. And then in Japan, he's known as Kwanzeon or Kwannon or Kanon. And Avalokiteshvara is especially revered in Tibet and the whole Himalayan region. Anyone who's been trekking in those areas will have come across roadside shrines to him, like this one, and prayer wheels and prayer flags and prayer stones and prayer walls, all of which contain his mantra. And the mantra is pronounced on an Om Mani Padme Hum. And yeah, I'll say a little bit about what it means later on. Okay, so just a little bit about what he looks like. The four-armed version, which you can see here, like many archetypes, is portrayed, actually you can't quite see it in this image, is portrayed usually as sitting on a lotus throne. And the lotus throne is covered by a mat, and the mat is traditionally the moon itself, so he sits on a moon mat. He is traditionally white, snowy white, and like all bodhisattvas, he's in the prime of youth. He's comely, he looks gentle, but strong. And he's seated in the full lotus meditation posture. He wears usually exotic robes, sometimes very bright colours. And he's often surrounded by an aura of light, like most of the bodhisattvas, just to, as a sort of reminder that we're looking at an enlightened being. You will see an aura behind most of the bodhisattvas. And the commonest form, the one with four arms, usually has two pairs of hands, and the central hand, the central pair of hands, is folded in the Anjali or prayer mudra, like this. And you'll recognize this mudra because you often do it when you come to meditate here and we salute the shrine before meditation. But he's holding in his folded hands, he's holding something very precious. You can sometimes, in some images you can see it and in some you can't, but traditionally he is holding to his heart a jewel, and it's an incredibly precious jewel. The jewel is known as the Chintamani, and the Chintamani Mani is a jewel. The Chintamani is known as the wish-fulfilling jewel. It's the jewel that, it's like Aladdin's lamp. It gives you anything you want. It's the fulfillment of all your deepest heart's desires. And because Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva, his deepest desire is enlightenment for all beings. And Mahayana Buddhism has a term for this aspiration for enlightenment for all beings, and it's the term is the bodhicitta. Bodhi as in enlightenment, and chitta as in mind or heart. The heart wish for enlightenment, if you like, for all beings. So Avalokiteshvara holds the bodhicitta to his heart because it's the only thing that will give true happiness and is therefore the only antidote for the suffering that he sees around him when he looks down to the world. Okay, so that's the inner hands. The outer hands contain two different things. In his outer right hand, he has a crystal mala, a string of beads. And it's a string of beads on which he counts out his mantra. And at each repetition of the mantra, a being is released from samsara, because, this is the bodhisattva who is going to save beings from their suffering. He's going to release them from samsara by getting them to enlightenment. And the outer left hand contains a lotus flower. The lotus flower in Buddhism is a very powerful symbol of the potential of every human being for enlightenment. And it's a reference to the Buddha's vision after he became enlightened, when he is said to have seen, he had a vision of, all the beings of the world, the past, present, and future, as lotuses. And these lotuses were some of them out in the sun, opening to the sun, some of them still as buds, some in water, still submerged by the water, and some of them just as potential buds, way down in the mud, hardly visible, hardly there, but waiting to come out, waiting to grow. And the point of that story, as the Buddha told it, was that all beings, even those sunk deep in the mud, have the potential for enlightenment. So that's what the lotus held in Avalokiteshvara's outer left hand represents. It's reminding us that we all have the potential for enlightenment. So, there are three references to the lotus in the figure of Avalokiteshvara. There's the lotus throne on which he sits. There is the lotus that he holds in his hand. And there's also the lotus that is symbolised by the Anjali Mudra. Because this mudra that you make when you're saluting the shrine actually represents something. It represents a lotus. Your hands represent a lotus bud. And when you make the Anjali Mudra, you usually hold your hands like that, with your thumbs together. And the thumbs inside of your folded hands represent the jewel that the Buddha Avalokiteshvara holds to his heart. So the Anjali Mudra refers to the jewel in the lotus, the potential in every human being for enlightenment. So that is what Avalokiteshvara's mantra refers to. Mani means jewel, Padme means lotus. So Om Mani Padme Hum means Om, the jewel in the lotus, Hum. So the title of this talk and very much the theme of the Avalokiteshvara image is the jewel in the lotus. Okay, so that's a little bit about the four-armed form of Avalokiteshvara. Up here we've got an image of, what in a way is one of the most bizarre images of Buddhist iconography. It's actually, in a way, not a very beautiful image, I think. Or the image itself somehow always seems a bit clunky. But the ideal that the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara portrays is a really, really beautiful, beautiful ideal. So this form of Avalokiteshvara is usually portrayed standing. I think standing for a number of reasons, actually. I think standing because ready for action, in a way. Usually, for reasons that I really don't understand, he has stripy trousers. This one has red and blue trousers, but quite often they're striped. And I'm sure there's some esoteric significance to that I haven't understood, but there you go. Anyway, the striking thing about this image of Avalokiteshvara is that he's surrounded by what, from a distance, looks like a great circle of light. Or actually, I think with a bit of imagination, the outstretched wings of a great angel. And that's kind of how I think of Avalokiteshvara in my mind. So this is the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And there's a very beautiful myth about how the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara came to be. It's related in a work called The Door of Liberation by a Tibetan teacher called Gampopa. The myth tells how the novice bodhisattva called Avalokiteshvara, so Avalokiteshvara when he was a novice bodhisattva, made a very solemn vow to save all beings of all ages from the sufferings of samsara. Samsara is the sort of the mythic term for the world that we live in, the world that has lots of suffering in it. And in the manner of mythic vows, to show that he was really serious, he wished that, should he fail in his endeavour, in his determination to save all beings to enlightenment from suffering, then his body would shatter into 1,000 pieces. Okay. And interestingly, he set out on his quest to save all beings by entering into a very deep meditation. And after he'd meditated very, very hard, very, very deeply, for a long, long, long time, he just sneaked a peek to see how he was doing. He kind of looked down at samsara just to see how he was getting on and how many beings were saved. And he was really disheartened because he realized just how many beings there were still to be saved. And he was completely overwhelmed by the thing that he'd undertaken. And of course, because he despaired, because he was overwhelmed by the whole thing, his body shattered into 1,000 pieces. So the story goes, the myth goes, that Avalokiteshvara screamed out in pain to the Buddha Amitabha. Amitabha is traditionally the great compassionate Buddha of the West. And Amitabha came to his aid and put his body back together in a form that was really more suited to his purpose. Not with two or four arms and one head, but with 1,000 arms and with 11 heads. And in this image, the inner arms, like on the forearm of Avalokiteshvara, is in the Anjali Mudra, holding the jewel, holding the Chintamani to his heart. The second pair of hands are holding the lotus and the mala, as they are in the forearmed version. And then the other 996 hands are reaching out in all directions, reaching out to beings in all the quarters and in all the times to offer assistance, to offer whatever assistance is needed. And if you look closely at images of the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, you'll see that quite a lot of the hands are holding all sorts of implements, tools, just all sorts of things that might be useful in the quest to help save all beings. And the other quite beautiful iconography, part of the iconography in a way, is that each hand of Avalokiteshvara contains an eye. And the idea is that these 1,000 eyes are seeing what's going on with beings, seeing the suffering of beings, seeing really what's needed by people who need help. And the 11 heads are facing in all the directions so that they can see all round, they can see everyone, they can see what's going on everywhere. There's traditionally three rows of three, which you can see on this one. And then, interestingly, a wrathful head. But I suppose there's a sense in which that's showing that the compassion of Avalokiteshvara can be fierce as well as gentle. And then at the very top, there is the red head of the Buddha Amitabha. So Amitabha, in a way, is giving his own head. He's giving his own mind as an aid to Avalokiteshvara. Okay, so that's the symbolism of the figures of Avalokiteshvara, whose heart is full of compassion for all beings, who holds the jewel in the lotus as a symbol of the bodhicitta, and whose many hands are extended in all directions to help all of the beings of samsara. So he obviously represents an incredibly lofty ideal. And I want to spend most of my talk just exploring three aspects of the symbolism of Avalokiteshvara. So the first one is what we hold to our hearts. The second is the jewel in the lotus. And the third is about helping hands. So I want to start with a memory, a personal memory. It's a very small thing that happened about 15 years ago. And I remember it. It's a very, very small thing, but I remember it clearly because it taught me something about myself. So it's a weekend morning, been quite a hard week at work. Weekends, I was often very tired in those days. And I was sitting in bed having tea with Vidanya. And Vidanya was anticipating a lazy and restorative morning, but I had other ideas. I said, I'm going to get up and make that raised bed. And Vidanya immediately said, how do you do that? And he wasn't being sarcastic. He genuinely meant, how do you do that? And when I asked him to explain, he said, how do you summon up the energy to get up at an ungodly hour on a weekend morning, it was probably about 9:30 by this time, and go and work. And so I thought about it, and well, we had been talking about growing vegetables. This was in the days before the allotment that many of you will know about. And we had this idea that we could construct a raised bed at the bottom of our garden. And I'd noticed that we had some waste wood in our cellar, and I thought, well, maybe, you know, we could put those together and we could make this raised bed. And actually, what the conversation made me realise is that I'm really good at wanting. I mean, most of us are good at wanting, aren't we, to be fair? But sometimes we do it in a vague, sometime in the future sort of way. But I'm really greedy. I want things now, as soon as possible. I want them so much that I'm willing to forego a lie-in and the discomfort of labouring and all the frustrations of DIY in order to make a raised bed. So people occasionally ask me where I get my energy from, and I guess that's where I get it from. I'm just greedy. I'm really good at wanting things. And in some ways, that is the key to the figure of Avalokiteshvara, and the compassion that he represents, and all the positive emotion that that streams from that compassion. The key to compassion, really, and to all positive emotion, is in our hearts. But it isn't necessarily about feeling. Mostly, it's about wanting. As Leela Mati said when she was talking here last week, I think her quote was that someone had said to her, love is a decision, it isn't a feeling. It's something that you decide to do. Okay, I agree with that. It isn't a feeling. And actually, the word emotion is obviously about movement. It's got the word motion in it. It's about what moves us, what propels us into action. Sometimes we talk about being moved by something that we see or hear. And what we mean is that our emotions have been stirred. And that's usually because it chimes with something that we want very much. And wants don't have to be as basic as wanting a raised bed. In fact, if we're moved by something, it's likely that it's because we've seen a demonstration of values that we think are really, really important. Values that we really care about, like love or kindness or peace. Things that we value for ourselves and that we want for other people and that we want for the world. And that's what Avalokiteshvara is signalling with that central mudra. What we want, what we hold in or what we hold to our hearts is incredibly, incredibly important. So, what do we hold in our hearts? When we talk in the newcomers course about why they've come on the course, people talk about a wish for happiness, wanting inner peace, relief from stress, a better world. And you've all done that course. Presumably you wanted that happiness or peace or whatever it was that you wanted enough to finish the course and then start coming along on Sangha night. And many of you have been coming along for many years. Something actually keeps you coming. If we want something, and if we want it enough, then we'll put up with quite a lot of discomfort, actually, to move towards it. In a way, the secret of spiritual progress, of enlightenment itself, in fact, is just wanting it enough. So it's also the key to the Metta-Bhavana meditation. So Metta-Bhavana meditation. The mindfulness of breathing is training our minds. I think the Metta-Bhavana meditation is training our hearts. And it's almost certainly the meditation that Avalokiteshvara was doing when he's referred to at the beginning of the Heart Sutra. Those of you who've heard the Heart Sutra will be familiar with the lines, the Bodhisattva of compassion when he meditated deeply. Okay, Avalokiteshvara doing the Metta-Bhavana. I'll say more about that in a minute. So when I started out with meditation, I was definitely a mindfulness of breathing person. And I found the metabhavana just a bit baffling, actually. My relationships with my family and my friends were warm enough, but if I sat down to meditate and tried to summon up feelings of warmth or even a sort of cool affection, they just didn't come. The person leading the meditation would talk about, you know, going to your heart area and contacting feelings of warmth. And I would think, don't think so, can't find them. And actually, I quite often felt a bit of a failure with a metta-bhavana. I wondered if I was actually, at my heart of hearts, a bit cold-hearted, really. And a big breakthrough came with me, actually in another conversation with Vidanya, a decade or more after that first one. Oh, no, it's probably about the same time, actually, when I think about it. Anyway, some time ago. And in that conversation, he commented how much of meditation is about the power of intention. Now, at the time, I was preparing a short talk about my meditation practice. And so I was thinking about meditation, and I had a bit of a realization. So for many, many years, my regular morning meditation had been dominated by the sort of distraction that you're almost bound to have if you've got a big job and a busy life and a not very well-trained mind, which is definitely what I had. But actually, through many years, a decade or more actually, of meditating really badly every morning, I changed enormously. And it certainly wasn't through dwelling in the dhyanas, and it definitely wasn't through reflecting deeply on the Dharma, because I didn't manage to get anywhere near either of those. I just kept going with distracted meditation through years because I knew that I was happier and more together if I did a meditation, even a really distracted one, every morning. And every now and again I stopped and I thought, nope, I'm just not as happy when I'm not meditating. Better start again. Okay, so through many years, I was sitting down with a daily intention of, well, something. I suppose the daily intention was to be happier, to be kinder, to be a bit more aware. And actually, the power of intention, the power of wanting, just really came home to me. I changed enormously just by connecting with that intention and doing something about it day after day for many years. Okay, I've since learnt that a vague intention isn't as powerful as a focused and vividly imagined intention. So I have got better at the metta-bhavana. These days, I start off with self-metta, and I, as vividly as I can, I imagine the person that I want to be. I imagine a much wiser and warmer and more unshakable version of myself, a much more developed version of myself, someone who, from whom positive mental states just flow, compassion and love just keep flowing. And, okay, I imagine it as vividly as I can, and that just seems to have a lot more juice in it than passively repeating the phrases that we all learn when we start to do the metta-bhavana. And similarly for the other stages, imagining my friends' happiness, they're feeling confident and content and at peace, them being truly happy, and imagining that as vividly as I can. So the key to pursuing our heart's desire is imagining as vividly as we can possibly manage to do so. Because there's a sense in which what we imagine, we move towards. Eventually, we become that. I just remembered something when I was writing the talk that you may find funny. Some of you will remember something that happened in the 1980s. There was a particular cult that made itself very popular by recruiting a lot of people who desperately wanted something like a big car or a big house or a big job or a big salary. And they were slightly taken the piss out of by others, and they became known as the Chanting for a Porsche lot. I know nothing about them at all, nothing. But it's my guess that chanting for Porsche was based on imagining yourself as the owner or the driver of this gorgeous car, of really, really wanting that wonderful car. And, well, you know, if you imagine something that you want very vividly, very often, you're kind of sending a message to your subconscious mind. And your subconscious mind will start looking out for opportunities that might help you move towards being the possessor of that amazing car. So, yeah, be careful what you wish for. I'm not sure that a Porsche is really sufficient to satisfy your heart's desire. But you might take a more strategic approach to it. Okay, so a little bit about the jewel in the lotus now. Okay, so what Avalokiteshvara holds to his hand, holds in his hands, holds to his heart, is the Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling gem, the bodhicitta, the heart wish for enlightenment for all beings. And I've said that we need to imagine our heart's desire, but there's a bit of a conundrum here, because I can imagine a more developed version of myself, but I can't actually imagine enlightenment, because in a way it's beyond my experience. And, okay, there's a couple of things we can do about that, a couple of ways we can address that conundrum. Following the imagining suggestion, well, okay, I can imagine my future self in which the bodhicitta has arisen, perhaps. Imagine the stream of metta and compassion and gratitude and joy and peace of mind that would flow from that on the basis of what we imagine that we come. But I can actually also dwell on something that is within my experience and is probably within most people's experience. So when I'm inspired, when I'm in a particularly positive state of mind, I sometimes get a glimmer of something that is, well, this is nigh on impossible to describe in words. And if pressed, I would describe it as a sort of light or brilliant blur, a wordless wishing, perhaps, or an intuitive knowing, or a love of what's beautiful. And, okay, none of those describe it really quite, but they're sort of in the area. But it does actually feel quite significant when it happens. It feels real and it feels important. And it feels, in some ways, quite close to my experience of metta. In fact, when I'm feeling that kind of inspiration, if I bring anyone to mind, or even bring anything to mind, what I feel is metta for it. I feel a whole lot of metta. So there's a sense in which it's a state in which there are lots of positive states of mind. And I believe that that most of us have moments like that, when we are, in a sense, just touched with enlightenment. They're moments usually when our motivation is pure. There can be moments of love, moments of experiencing beauty, flashes of insight. Our problem is that they just don't last. They're fleeting, we can't hang on to them. But actually, if you can, it's worth remembering them as vividly as you can. Sometimes, for me, it kind of helps to remember where in my body I felt that. And it might be in your heart, it might be in your guts. Sorry about the microphone. Yeah, but it's worth just trying to recall, to remember, to get a glimmer of what that inspiration felt like. And actually, if you want to develop emotionally and spiritually, then you should encourage experiences like that by putting yourself into conditions where they can happen. And for me, there are loads and loads of conditions where it might happen. It might happen in meditation, actually. It might happen in nature. It might happen when I'm reading poetry, looking at art, listening to music, doing puja. Quite often at the end of a really good puja, especially here when there's a whole lot of us being doing doing a puja together, I can feel very inspired. It might be being with people that I love or just doing something I love, being out in the garden and kind of just noticing things in the garden. And Sangharacharya says something very interesting about these moments of appreciating beauty or feeling inspired. He says that in appreciating beauty, and the same thing applies to, you know, feeling love and so on, feeling inspired, the subject-object duality drops away and we experience a moment of non-duality. So non-duality, the self that is the problem that we struggle with in a way as Buddhists, drops for a while, and we have just a moment, just a taste, just a foretaste, a glimmer of what enlightenment might be like. So putting ourselves in conditions where we feel inspired is almost a spiritual duty. It's part of our spiritual and emotional training, the training of the heart. Okay, so finally something about helping hands. I said I'd come back to the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara in the Heart Sutra, as I said earlier, is probably doing the Metta-Bhavana meditation. And the Heart Sutra says, when he meditated deeply, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, so Avalokiteshvara, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. So this is Avalokiteshvara breaking through from meditation to enlightenment, seeing things the way they really are. And that's interesting, really, because the Heart Sutra is a condensation of some of the longer Perfection of Wisdom sutras. It's called the Heart Sutra because it's the heart of the Perfection of Wisdom. And the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, or one of them, is traditionally the book that Manjushri holds to his heart. Remember Manjushri, the Bodhisattva that Vedanya was talking about a few weeks ago? He holds a book to his heart. Traditionally, that book is the Perfection of Wisdom. So we've got the Bodhisattva of Compassion as an interloper, maybe, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Okay, so why? We've also, I will come back to that in a minute, we've also, in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which is the Buddha's teaching on the meditation that we do here, in the Metta-Bhavana meditation, where the Buddha gives instructions in the Karaniya Metta Sutta for doing the Metta-Bhavana meditation, he gives the instructions, and then he makes a promise about the results of the practice. He says that if we do the Metta-Bhavana, you will experience the spiritual insight that is beyond words and concepts, and going completely beyond craving, you will be liberated from the wheel of samsara forever. So the Buddha is saying that practicing the Metta-Bhavana meditation can lead you to insight, can lead you to all the way to enlightenment. So, so here we have both the Heart Sutra and the Karaniya Metta Sutta, promising that the emotions, that the practice of metta can lead us all the way to enlightenment. So how's that? I think it's because when we reflect, when we dwell on our heart's desire, when we look at our heart's desire for happiness, and then we think about what other beings want in their heart of hearts, we realise that actually other people want pretty much the same as us. That it isn't just me who wants happiness in my heart of hearts, everybody does. It's a common wish. And I couldn't possibly be happy if people around me were suffering. So practising the Metta-Bhavana will lead us further and further towards a realisation of the inextricable interconnectedness of all beings, in fact, of everything, which is, of course, the true nature of things. Everything is connected. There are no separate selves. There is just flow. There are just beings. So Avalokiteshvara is also a wisdom symbol. He holds the bodhicitta to his heart, and he simultaneously works for the benefit of all beings, reminding them of their potential for enlightenment with the lotus, and counting off beings helped with his mala, and helping in all sorts of other ways with these 996 other hands. Shantideva, who many of you will have come across, he's the author of a very much revered work on the Bodhisattva path. Shantideva points out that our hands wouldn't ignore an injury to our foot just because it's a different limb and therefore nothing to do with it, none of our business, as it were. A wider view of the body means that we will help our injured foot with our hand because it's connected, it's a part of us. So he says in the same way, we should want to relieve the suffering of other beings just because it's suffering, regardless of whose suffering it is. So the many hands of Avalokiteshvara are a symbol of interconnectedness. And the fact that they're united around the bodhicitta makes Avalokiteshvara a particularly potent symbol for the joint aspirations of a spiritual community, which is why the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara has been adopted as the symbol of the Triratna Buddhist order and community. And it's a symbol, so it's this symbol, the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And it's a symbol that I find particularly inspiring. I look around at our spiritual community and see people of all ages and backgrounds practicing together with one aspiration, which is, in the words of the Buddha, for the welfare of the many. And I love the idea of having a task in common with all of you, with all of our Sangha, with having a common aspiration. I love the idea of sharing our hearts and minds in discussion groups, as we will later, of gardening together, of giving money, even love giving money. So our centre can be a place where people will meet and practice the Dharma for generations to come. And that's what the act of compassion of Avalokiteshvara is like. It's not just a warm feeling, but it's really working together for the welfare of others. Okay, so I'm nearly finished, and in the tradition of talks, I'm going to just give some tips on what can this mean for our practice. And I just want to say five things, five tips, as it were. The first one is follow your heart's desire. Know what you want and go for it. Wanting is powerful. Be clear what you want, so you're not drifting between a whole clutch of kind of vague, might want it sort of notions, half-formed wishes. And so you're not driven by your unconscious wants. Make what you want clear and then go for it. And that probably means imagining what you want as vividly as you can manage. Imagine how wonderful it will be, how wonderful it will feel. So I probably wouldn't have agreed to give this talk. I don't find writing talks easy. Or do any of the other things that I do at the centre, if I hadn't had a strong sense of how important the Sangha is and how important what we're doing here is. If I didn't have a premonition of how lives, both now and in the future, are going to be changed in the Sheffield area by what we're doing at this centre. Okay, so follow your heart's desire. Second thing is train your emotions. Do the metta bhavana. Okay, full stop. You know the metta bhavana. Do it, because it trains your heart. It trains your emotions. Third thing, hold the jewel in the lotus. Hold to your heart what's most precious to you. So connect with your heart's desire as often as you can. Definitely when you meditate, and as often as you can at other times. So beginning of a meditation session, it's often really good to consciously think, why am I sitting here to meditate? What do I want through practicing meditation? What do I want through my Buddhist practice? And think about it. Imagine what it is that you want as vividly as you can. And you can also hold the jewel in the lotus in a very practical way. When we're saluting the shrine, you can remember what the Anjali Mudra actually means. You can remember the jewel in the lotus, the potential for enlightenment in all living beings, and that means you, everybody. Fourth thing, become an arm of Avalokiteshvara. Practice active compassion. Be actively part of our Sangha. Take part in things. Come on a Sangha retreat. Become a Mitra, maybe. Help the Sheffield Buddhist Centre to give the gift of the Dharma to people in the future. You might do that by volunteering in a very practical way with cleaning or gardening. Or bookkeeping, we need a bookkeeper at the moment. Or you might give money. We definitely need money at the moment. And it'll be very good, it'll be very well spent and a good cause. And the fifth thing that you can do is call on the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So when Avalokiteshvara was in trouble, the myth says, he called on Amitabha. And, well, if interconnectedness is true and we're all part of one great reality, then you and I and Amitabha and Avalokiteshvara, who've actually been around for quite a lot longer than us, are all part of that same reality. So when we call up to those higher aspects of reality, it's just possible that something might reach down and give us a hand. So you could do worse than calling on Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, the Lord who looks down, who is tuned in to the cries of the world. And perhaps, actually, he's the archetypal figure who's most likely to respond if you call on someone for help. And the most direct way of doing that is probably to chant his mantra. So I'll finish the talk by saying, Om Mane Padme Hum. Om, the jewel in the lotus, Hung. Okay, so that's it.